refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar. Refi Revival, stay ahead of the curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today.
Welcome to Market Advantage, the monthly podcast from Optimal Blue. Tune in for valuable insights from the Market Advantage Mortgage Data Report and in-depth conversations with industry experts. Stay competitive and optimize your advantage in the ever-evolving mortgage landscape.
Welcome to the Market Advantage podcast. This month, we're going to look at data highlights from August. Then we're going to sit down with our guest. We have Optimal Blue's Chief Technology Officer, Sivar Suleiman, joining us. Mike, Brennan, welcome. Great to see you both.
Likewise, Olivia, as always.
Excited to be here.
So we have the Labor Day holiday behind us. What did we see in August in terms of data?
Well, we had sort of currents moving in different directions that netted out to a 2% decline in total rate lock volume. We had purchase activity sort of trailing off here as we passed the peak buying season. We're down 10% in August relative to July. And that outweighed a pretty strong improvement on the rate and term refi volume side. So we were up 70% with rate term refinances, given the improvement in mortgage rates. So rates, a little bit of rally. I know there's a lot of discussion around upcoming rate cuts. Market seems to be building in some expectations around those. The OBMMI 30-year conforming rate, that's the benchmark for the CME OB 30 mortgage rate future, finished the month right about 6.5, down nearly a quarter of a point from July. A few other rates here. Jumbo rates dropped 30 bips to 6.57. FHA fell roughly 25 bips to 6.25, and VA was down 33 bips all the way to 6 flat. So hopefully we continue the rally on the rate side and can start to sniff some 5 handles here in September. A few other odds and ends in terms of production. Conforming gave up a 1% share in terms of its total market production, primarily to VA and then a little bit to the non-agency space as well. And then PUD volume, we've talked about this in the past, but the trend continued, the decline here. We're seeing less and less PUD, planned unit development production in our rate lock volume. That's a really good proxy for new construction. So the mortgage lending that's related to new construction continues to fall. It's from a market share perspective, it's down to 28%. It was up near a third last year. So at the same time last year, so we're down from roughly a third of production to starting to creep towards a quarter of production being related to new construction. So I do think that that's probably telling us something about what's going on in the builder community, maybe availability of some of the homes, the lock-in effect may be starting to loosen a little bit. So more of the inventory that's available for sale starting to come from existing homes versus new construction. Otherwise, a couple other items, first-time homebuyer percentages were mostly flat. VA ticked down a bit. And I just say the non-QM production, slow and steady increase here. We hit 8% in terms of total production from non-QM last month. It's up to about 8.5 here. So I don't think that's a trend that's going to be changing anytime soon. So for folks that are not yet in the non-QM game, I think everybody will be in some shape or form here in the near term. Mike, I think that's it on the origination side. So I'll pass it over to you for the secondary stats.
Yeah, thanks for passing that over to me, Brent. I think the one thing on non-QM that's interesting is just to kind of take a step back and think about where it started. You go back to like the COVID era time, that was like a 1.5-2% of originations. And just to like see that, how much that's grown in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, it's definitely something that seems like it has some staying power. But over to the secondary side, you know, a big number that we saw change this month was in our hedge loan sales. And we continued to see a shift to MBS securitization. It moved from 37% to 40% of the loan sales that we've observed in our hedging platforms. It just kind of continues to beat home that point where we might be seeing some market shift from, you know, small to mid IMBs, small credit unions and banks, to maybe more of these larger institutions that are either depositories that have other businesses that allow them to shift, you know, the rates that they're able to give folks, or you're seeing the very large IMBs, publicly traded companies, really starting to shift their economies of scale, shift that muscle that they have there. We saw cash percentage of sales drop 2%, and we saw bulk loan sales to other aggregators drop 2% as well. Oddly enough, we also saw best efforts increase about 1%, which was interesting as well. Another stat to think about too that I want to call out is the shift in loan sale by price. So this month, we actually saw quite a large increase in loans sold to the highest price. That went from 70%, that was at 70% last month, that now increased to 75%. So that softer eligibility concern, things like representative mix, trying to make sure all your investors get equal slices of your origination markup, is starting to see a decrease where it seems like lenders are chasing price. And they need to chase as many basis points as humanly possible in terms of maximizing their gain on sale. One more stat that I wanted to call out was what happened with servicing rights. So mortgage servicing rights move in line with rates. So as mortgage rates drop, the value of servicing will drop with it. So with OBMMI dropping quite a bit this month, we saw on average the servicing rights recognized at the point of sale drop almost about 4 basis points this month, a shade under 5 basis points, went from about 1.2 to about 1.15 as a percentage of price for servicing rights. On average, OBMMI was down somewhere between 14 and 15 basis points this month. When you look over the course of the month, we know we ended about 0.25 point down, but over that period of time, we saw the servicing rights drop about, you know, 5 basis points in value. And that's coming out of people's margin, right? You know, the value of servicing is a lever that folks can pull from a profitability standpoint in their margin. You know, an interesting thing also on this point is we saw the primary secondary spread widen this month. So what that means is, you know, lenders, as rates drop, they're unsure how long they're going to drop, and they're unsure if they have the capacity to handle more origination. So they'll widen that profit margin. So what that means is that even though it dropped 5 basis points, the average servicing value, we may see it drop more as that primary secondary spread tightens if we're in this rate environment for a prolonged period of time, which would be an interesting thing to kind of track there.
Great. Thanks, guys. So I think it would be a good moment to talk stats of the month. Anything stand out to either one of you that you want to share?
An interesting stat that I wanted to call out was the share of loans eligible for a spec payup. This is not something that we are tracking just yet in the Market Advantage. Consider this our trial balloon. But you know, the agencies recently came out with additional loan characteristics eligible for a spec payup. So, you know, back in the day, it used to be if your loan was less than 200K, you would receive a payup. And the idea there is that it takes a lot of rate move for those loans with low loan amounts to actually refi, because the payment savings, you know, typically don't outweigh the closing costs, right? You're not going to pay 10, 15K of closing costs if you're only saving $50 a month in payment, right? It just takes too long to make that investment work. But as we've seen home price appreciation and inflation go up, we've seen investors and buyers of mortgage-backed securities go higher and higher looking for that call protection, they call it. And recently, Fannie and Freddie both released a 325 and a 350K spec payup. And so the average loan amount that we see in OB is somewhere in that 380 percentage. So one of the things I wanted to look at was if you looked at loans eligible for a low balance payup, if you looked at things that are also inherently have some call protection, there are certain states that have, you know, refi taxes. There are certain credit stories such as lower FICO bands that people think have some type of, you know, call protection from a prepayment standpoint. There's also, you know, agency programs like Home Ready, Home Possible, Mission Score that also get spec payups because of this call protection that they're looking for, right? The idea that you need to have loans that won't prepay as fast as you think. And so when we looked across the population of loans across, you know, our hedging clients, it was actually quite astonishing how much of the population of loans is eligible for some type of spec payup. It was at just a little under 70% last month of loans that were eligible for a specified payup. Now, the vast majority of that came from loans less than 350K. About 55% of loans are actually less than 350K from a loan amount that we see in our hedging system. So all those loans are eligible for some type of, you know, pay up from an investor. And then you see things such as investments in second homes, right? A lot of folks think that those loans have punitive LLPAs, and we see some people pay up for them. You see FICO is less than 700. You see Mission Score, Home Ready, Home Possible kind of make up that balance. But I think it's an interesting thing to track to see how much of the loans eligible in the secondary market to be sold actually are not going to be delivered into a TBA and potentially delivered into a spec pool instead. That's an interesting trend for us to watch, especially when it comes in regard to hedging instruments, because it could call into question the sanctity of the TBA as that hedge that everyone uses from a risk management perspective.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, and one we probably will, you know, want to start tracking a little bit more closely on the Market Advantage and on our reporting here. That I've actually got two stats of the month here, if you'll indulge me. So one maybe more related to what we're talking about here. On the refinance side, although we were up 70% month over month here in August, we were actually down 10% year over year. So it seems like forever ago, but we were at a kind of like low sixes in terms of rates in the fall of 24. And so we're actually down year over year. And September was a really strong month for refinances last year. And I think we were about an eighth of a rate or an eighth of a point up where we were in August of last year, and about down 10%. So it gives us some amount of sort of ability to look into the crystal ball and say, well, you know, if we pick up another eighth, probably going to be another 10% plus pickup, especially given the additional production that's occurred between now and this time last year and the additional folks who are going to be in the money here. So definitely some more optimism if rate trends continue along this path. And then the other bonus to the bonus stat, which I can't help myself here, Vince Lombardi picture behind me, Reggie White and one other player are the only two defensive ends in NFL history to have 12 or more sacks in their first 4 years playing in the NFL. The other individual is the recently acquired by the Green Bay Packers, Micah Parsons. So I'll leave you both with that. And we're very excited for the start of the NFL season here.
Brennan, did you know that stat from memory, or did you look that up? I have to ask.
Any Packer stats like that, they're not in my memory. They're in my soul, Olivia.
Fair enough.
Yeah. As a Penn State guy, I'm rooting for you. Micah Parsons is a beast, and Nittany Lions are number two in the country. So we could both be happy, Brennan.
All right. Thanks, guys. Okay, it's time to welcome this month's guest. I'm so excited. We have our Chief Technology Officer, Siver Suleiman, joining us. Siver, welcome to the Market Advantage.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we wanted to have you today because you just gave a really interesting presentation at HousingWire's AI Summit, and your topic was how to measure and maximize ROI on your AI investments. So you're certainly one of our AI experts here at Optimal Blue, and I thought your content was so good. I had the pleasure of being in the audience, seeing it in real time, kind of wanted to dig a little deeper on some of the concepts you presented. So to kind of kick off, one thing that I thought was really interesting and that I could tell really resonated and got the audience thinking too was this concept of the AI hype cycle. Can you explain what that is for the audience?
Yeah, certainly. So that's actually a study chart that was drawn by Gartner. And it was specific to using Gen AI for coding assistant. But I believe it applies to just using generative AI in general, not just for coding assistant. And the way they described it is kind of a two dimensions, right? Time and expectation. So at the beginning of what they called an innovation trigger, where the company or any company would say, okay, this generative AI, let's go implement it, right? So there was no expectation. And this happened to us, Optimal Blue, in October 2023. We started saying, okay, generative AI is becoming a thing. Let's explore it. So we had no expectation. And then as we were learning about what it can and cannot do, the expectations went high, right? And that's where everybody kind of, they had a peak of inflation of everything that it can do. It can probably take a financial document and decipher it and extract all the data elements out of it with no errors. So that's kind of the peak of inflation, of inflated expectations, as they called it. But slowly, as we started experimenting with generative AI tools, with using LLMs directly or using some of the tools that were built on LLMs, we realized, and I think the industry in general, not just mortgage industry, I think all users in general, all implementers, realized that it really isn't magic, right? It's really more, it's a very complex, intelligent pattern matching algorithm that you can use in multiple use cases. So we came down to what Gartner calls the trough of disillusionment, right? Where we had a reality check, but then as we hit that sort of bottom, rock bottom, we're starting to climb up to that slope of enlightenment because we now know what we can and cannot do with it. For example, we always talk about prompt engineering. When you prompt an LLM, the more information you provide it, whether it's examples, the formats you want, experience, the better the response you're going to get from it. So just by learning, by using and getting experience with using generative AI, you're going to get a lot more out of it. So that's really that slope of enlightenment where you're going to move up because you know what it cannot do, but you really know how to harness the power of generative AI, the LLMs, the tools that are built on top of LLMs to maximize the use cases out of it. And at the end, you know, it kind of reaches that plateau of productivity, which I don't think any of us are there yet. You know, new versions of LLM come out, as you know, GPT-5 was just out a few weeks ago. So as we learn, they learn, the model producers also learn from us, from the experiences that we're having with it, and they improve their models as well. So I thought it was very relevant to show and kind of show where people are in general in terms of the hype cycle.
Steve, I thought that chart was super informative and I could see a lot of our kind of maturation through that process. One of the things I wanted to like pick your brain on that you mentioned during the conversation was this idea of like a small model language. Or a small language model instead of a large language model. Everybody keeps hearing about these large language models and, you know, more of how folks are figuring out how to, you know, optimize the operational side, like what models fit in what spots and how folks are tweaking those dials. So maybe you can just, you know, go off on those two points for a minute or two here.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think what the context of that discussion was around ROI, right? The return on investment or return on intelligence. And how do you maximize your return? One way is to sort of minimize your investment, right? And the idea was you have to look at your use case for generative AI. And not every use case requires a large language model, an LLM, right? You can actually potentially satisfy your use case using a small language model, right? And the difference between an SLM and an LLM is simply the number of parameters that the model is trained on, right? The size, right? So literally small versus large, right? So for example, a small language model is trained on could be 20 billion parameters. What that means is think of it as you have a machine with 20 billion tiny small knobs and your adjusting those knobs to, you know, maximize the capacity of your machine and the intelligence of your machine. Compare that to 1 trillion, right, for a GPT-4, which is a large language model. So there's no doubt that SLM is not going to have as, it's not going to be as complex, it's not going to be as accurate or as powerful as an SLM, but the small language model gives you a lot of benefits. One is a lot faster, because the processing will be faster. It's trained on, you know, smaller, the size of the static model is much smaller, has fewer parameters. And it can also run on a much smaller machine. So you can actually host it on your own cloud environment. You can even host it on a laptop, on a beefy laptop. And it doesn't require, you know, the sort of large 200 GPUs that a GPT-4 was trained on. The only difference really is just in the capacity, right, or in the accuracy and the ability to process very large documents or very large information. For example, you could have a 20-page financial document that you want to feed to an LLM. You may not get the same result from an SLM. And I'll give you an example. I was reading last week about Phi-3, for example. Phi-3 is a Microsoft SLM. They went through Phi-1, Phi-2, and now Phi-3. And Phi-3 is used by, there's a use case for agriculture. You know, farmers with no internet access, they have the ability, and they do this in India, they have the ability to use to build a complete model and a system around using that SLM to, and they fine-tuned it based on the information that they fed it with agricultural information. And farmers are able to use it with no internet access on a small machine. So it has its own use cases. It satisfies that use case. It may not be enough for a complex product like Ask Obi, but it certainly is good enough for a simpler use case that you just need language understanding or processing simple prompts or simple documents.
Yeah. So it basically comes down to the scale of the ask and the data digested, right? So if it's a very like down the middle like thing, like with not a lot of data, you could, you know, have some savings from a cost perspective on using an SLM versus an LLM. And any like feel for like, is there like a rule of thumb on like the cost savings between like an SLM or an LLM? Anything you could share on that front?
Yeah, I mean, the cost saving is, it could be significant, right? So, I mean, so if we just talk about the cost of an LLM, for example, right? The cost of an LLM, a large language model like GPT-4 or GPT-5, those you cannot host on your laptop, and you cannot, I wouldn't recommend that you host it in your own cloud environment because you're going to need a lot of GPUs, right? So you naturally would use the one that is hosted by Microsoft, Azure, or other cloud environments. For those, you pay by token, right? And that token usage, unless you can predict it and you buy a reserved instance, it could get pretty pricey. With an SLM, if you're hosting it yourself, you don't pay anything. Right, because all you pay for is the machine that you're hosting it on, and some of them are open source that you can just bring in. I don't believe there is a license cost for Phi-3. You download the model, you host it on your own machine, your cost is virtually zero. While an LLM, you pay for tokens every time you run a prompt, you're paying for that.
That's super interesting. So it's almost like a true SaaS model, right? Like where you like can pay for it, download it, you have access to it, use it as much as you want, as compared to like the model you mentioned for the large language models, where it's a fee plus usage, right? Or per scale that you're paying for.
Exactly. You definitely pay for the usage of the LLM with tokens.
There was another point that you brought up in your presentation that I just loved, especially like watching from the sidelines here within Optimal Blue. And being part of the beginning of getting some of this AI stuff off the ground here, was the center of excellence. And so I was hoping that you could spend a little bit of time taking the listeners through what the center of excellence concept means and then how we're setting that up here at Optimal Blue.
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up. And yes, Mike, you were certainly one of the first product adopters of AI within Optimal Blue, and we appreciate that. We talked about Compass Edge in our presentation at the end, and maybe we'll get to that. But as far as center of excellence, so for me, it is very important that anything we do in technology, right, that we have a good base and a good foundation. Just like when you build a new product, the first thing you want to do is design and build architecture. And also when we embark on any new process, just like generative AI, you have to, in my opinion, create that center of excellence. And what that means is you bring in expertise and you also grow expertise within your own team. We did hire a couple of AI architects from the outside. We partnered with Microsoft that helped us with, as you know, trained us on Copilot, trained us on machine learning, on LLMs, etc. But we also created a architecture team that is AI specific within Optimal Blue. So we trained that team. We invested heavily, invested in myself, getting myself educated, my architects educated. Mike, you're part of some of those training that we've done. So create that center of excellence, meaning you create a staff that is knowledgeable about where AI is, where generative AI is, where it's going, how we implement, and then experimenting with different use cases, right? We're not going to get it right the first time because we can overuse it or underuse it. So that's what we've done, right? And then that also goes to the technical operation aspect, right? Our CIO and Corey Pisik's team, they're also part of that center of excellence where they have AI experts within that environment, within that team, so we can move forward and advance the usage and utilization of generative AI as a whole in the company. And that's what I would recommend for any company that wants to, I mean, the center of excellence could be one or two people, but you got to have the time and the investment in those people to learn and give them the time to stay up to speed, go to training, go to the Microsoft events or the Amazon events, be part of webinars, read on what's coming next, and allow time to experiment with some of these new tools and new LLMs to see what they can do.
Yeah, I was just so happy to see that because I think it has been, you know, 18 months in the making of setting up that center of excellence here. And you mentioned like the great partnership we have with Microsoft and, you know, that helped us get kickstarted here, but we're also setting up our own kind of like foundation and theories here on like how to best deploy this stuff. And I think it culminates with the hackathon that we had a couple months back. There were just some really amazing use cases that were starting to come to life there. So I'm just super bullish on all the things that we're doing here about AI. You know, another question, Siever, just to keep drilling home on your presentation, was this idea of AI personas and the categories around there. Maybe you could just take us through what some of those categories are and where you see people fit. You know, I saw that Optimal Blue fit into a couple different spots there in the presentation. So maybe you could just take us through that.
Yeah, certainly. And it sounds like, Mike, you certainly were listening to the presentation. So thank you. So the way I thought about sort of, you know, presenting ROI, you kind of first have to talk about what is your role as a company in those, and I simplified into kind of three layers. Right at the bottom, you have the model producers, right? The people who actually build the models, you know, OpenAI, Google Gemini, Claude with, you know, with Sonnet, Anthropic, Claude, you know, and Microsoft, of course, we mentioned with SLMs. So that's kind of the model producer. And just on that, I think it's flattering when someone calls me or, you know, our colleagues that were at the Housing Wire AI expert. We really aren't, right? We're not AI experts. We're not the ones who built the generative AI models. We're becoming experts at using the generative AI models, right? That's really where our expertise come in. I mean, we understand how it was built and how what it is good for, but our expertise really is more in the utilization of these tools so that it can benefit our products, benefit our teams, and ultimately benefit our clients. But anyway, so and back to the stack of the three-layer stack. At the bottom, you have model producers, right? And then on the middle tier, you have the implementers. The implementer are those who actually kind of, you think of a low-level, right, implementation of the LLM directly in an application. And that's what Optimal Blue does, right? We use the LLMs in our Ask Obi, in our Originator Assistant. We use them in Compass Edge Assistants. So we go directly to the LLM, host it in the cloud, right, because we're not buying 200 GPUs. And that's the implementers. And you have some lenders who also are implementers, right? And you have other technology providers like us that could be also implementers. Clearly, OpenAI themselves implement an LLM in the ChatGPT application. Right? ChatGPT is an application that uses the GPT model. Same with Microsoft Copilot, right? They also use an LLM. And then at the very top of the three-stack layer is the users, right? The end user. So a mortgage lender who uses Optimal Blue's applications is an indirect user of generative AI LLMs because we implemented it. They're using our products, so they become an end user. And Optimal Blue ourselves, we use Microsoft Office 365 Copilot. So we're an end user of the implementer's application that uses the LLM. And of course, the world, you know, everybody uses ChatGPT or some other form of chat application based on an LLM. So everybody's an end user if you think about it.
So Siver, the crux of your presentation was making sure you're maximizing ROI with the AI you're using. So if I'm an end user, and to your point, we're all end users of AI, but particularly if I'm a mortgage lender using an AI tool, and I don't have any idea where to start in terms of measuring my ROI, what would your recommendation be?
Certainly. And just on the end user, just a sort of a side note, unrelated to the mortgage business, if you, as all of us, as end users, right, as people sitting at home using ChatGPT or Google Gemini, or, you know, it's now part of Google, how do we maximize our own ROI on using ChatGPT? It's my time spent typing a search. The way I could maximize it is by actually giving it a good prompt, right? Not just use it as a Google search. And you see this, you know, posts on LinkedIn and everywhere else, which is very true that most of us, including myself, were using ChatGPT as a Google search. But that's really not what it's built for. And we're actually costing OpenAI a lot of money, by the way. We don't know that, but every word we type in there, it's costing them money. But the way we would maximize as an end user our own utilization of it is really by using it and giving it prompts that really matter for us so we can get the answers. But back to the sort of the mortgage lenders and mortgage clients, I think the way you would maximize it is first you have to understand what is it that you're looking for, right? What is your use case and what is the best? And I talked about one of the items that sort of as part of your investment is in identifying high impact use cases, right? And that's what we did. And actually with Mike Vogue himself, right? About what, 18 months ago, we were new to generative AI. We started about 2 years ago, right? And we said, okay, what do we use it for? So we spent the time, we invested Optimal Blue's time in identifying high impact use cases for generative AI. And the result, the outcome was Compass Edge Assistance, which as if you saw the presentation at the end, we had a case study with our client, Mutual of Omaha, that is, they can't live without that information anymore. So that's really how you would maximize it by identifying, number one, high impact use cases. And then the other one is to understand your return, you have to understand your cost, right? So you have to baseline where you are. And that baseline could be in productivity. For example, if I have my development team using GitHub Copilot for productivity, I'm baselining my development velocity today, and I'm going to measure it in 6 months or 3 months or whatever to see what the difference is. Similarly, if you're a mortgage lender and you're doing, let's just talk about hedging, right? You baseline the time that you spend per loan, whether it's dollar amount or number of loans, before using, for example, Optimal Blue's Compass Edge Assistance, and after you use them, and you look at how much time it's saving you, that's your return, right? That's how you maximize your return by A, identifying your high impact use cases, and of course, by utilizing tools that are proven and tested. And you would let providers or vendors like us, whose job is to invest in AI for you, the lender, and trust us to sort of deliver those type of tools for you that maximizes your return on time, right? Whether that time is invested in AI or using our products.
Yeah, and just to build off that, especially with the Compass Edge Assistance, we spent time looking at what our desk and then what our clients did monotonously every day. So like, you know, the write-ups that come out of Compass Edge today that detail the top five reasons why your position changed or why you made or lost money, that was something, a repetitive task that somebody had to do every day. And sometimes it took 5 minutes, but there were those times where it would take 2 hours to figure out the reason why. And so, and then imagine now doing that at scale across the product. It used to be exemplary customer service or what the master user would be able to do. And now it's just baseline product functionality, right? It's an automatic email that comes out every morning that details the whys and hows. And there was a ton of iteration. And, you know, I got pretty good at writing these really long prompts that, like, I had to bring them down to manage tokens, et cetera. But it provided that, like, that change from, like, what I would call, like, exemplary service to, like, a baseline product feature changes that give people back time in their day so they could spend it on a strategy, right? You could spend it on figuring out, like, hey, how could I hedge more effectively, or what a different investor mix do I need to use? Do I need to stop using this different cross-hedge strategy that's not working? It allowed people more time to spend on these very strategic, kind of like deep thinking projects, as opposed to, like, oh, let me, like, knock out, you know, 50 items on the to-do list and do that because it's kind of easier, as opposed to spending time on, like, the harder deep thinking problem.
Exactly.
While we're talking about client benefits and client use cases, actually a question for either one of you, are there any other interesting use cases you've seen of, you know, ways our clients have been realizing ROI with our AI products?
Yeah, I think, you know, for example, we just launched, not just 6 months ago in our summit, our Originator Assistant, right? And the Originator Assistant, which is a sort of complex multi-LLM workflow of identifying additional products that a borrower can be eligible for. So the loan officer is looking at our PPA application and they have a loan scenario. The Originator Assistant is giving them the option of offering additional products and better pricing to the borrower if they improve upon, you know, certain parameters and minor small improvements on FICO and, you know, maybe putting a little more down payment, you know, $5,000 more in down payment, et cetera. So that has actually given the loan officers the ability to serve their borrowers in a better way, because they get a loan scenario, they get the products, if they just do a normal PPE search, a product of pricing engine search, but the Originator Assistant is giving them more options. So when a loan officer is able to satisfy their customers, which is the borrower, and give them more, they're going to get repeat customers. Hopefully they're going to get word of mouth and get more and more borrowers and be able to generate more loans.
Yeah, I love that feature. The one I'm going to call it, because we have so many right now, is Ask OB. Like, I just think that that brings back so much time into people's days, especially at the executive class of people who are typically, like, in a meeting and they just need that answer right now. Or they need the chart formatted for their PowerPoint that they're working on and it's 8 o'clock at night and no one's around. It kind of opens up that, like, anytime, anywhere access to data without having to know SQL queries. I definitely love a SQL query, but, like, it's not the same for everybody. Not everyone knows that language or understands that, even though ChatGPT makes it really easy. But Ask OB is that perfect, like, anytime assistant that allows folks to just make those decisions just way faster.
Exactly. And Ask OB is, I would say, our probably most complex AI product, and it's not one that we can use an SLM for sure. It has, it uses 9 LLM points, where it's an agentic workflow that uses an LLM at multiple points. And because it's so complex, I mean, we basically use our entire data set, right, to be able to answer those questions and identifying intent of the question. So it's very complex, and that's a really good use case for when you would want to invest in a large language model.
Perfect. Siver, this feels like a good moment to pose our bonus question to you. So we ask every guest this question to close us out. What is one thing, in your opinion, that you think lenders should be doing in today's market to maximize their profitability?
I'm going to answer that question specific to generative AI, because there are many ways you can do that, especially if you're a lender using Optimal Blue. And of course, I'm biased, you know, being with Optimal Blue. But specific to generative AI, I think you have to know where you are in that hype cycle, right? And if you are at the very beginning, you have to know that you're going to invest some time and money in training and building that center of excellence. And as I mentioned in the presentation, the good news for those that have not started with generative AI is they can basically go from number one to number four, meaning skip the peak of inflated expectations and skip the disillusionment and the disappointment and go to the slope of enlightenment. So you can skip those by learning from the rest of us. And of course, all the blogs and posts that you see on LinkedIn and other media. But that's what I would think, that if you are beginning with that, you can learn from others. But if you're doing a proof of concept, you can certainly make it a very low resource one, you know, with one or two people, and, you know, really stay up to speed with what's coming out. There are a lot of tools. Unfortunately, there's so many, right, that you have to filter out what is good and what's bad. So that's where kind of the center of excellence becomes important, because you have to have a team that is dedicated. It could be one person, right, that is dedicated to identifying what is a good tool or what's a good LLM for my use case and for my company. So I answered that specifically generative AI. That's how I think you can maximize your profitability on using it. And of course, like I said earlier, I mean, our business as technology providers is to invest in technology, is to invest in generative AI. Our center of excellence is going to be much bigger than the center of excellence of a lender whose business is really to generate and make loans, but rely on Optimal Blue to be that technology provider and stay up ahead of the innovation and generative AI. So you can always, you know, look to Optimal Blue for using, you know, generative AI and advanced technology to maximize your profitability.
Great answer. Thank you, Siever. And I'll be sure to include a link to see the hype cycle chart in our show notes so that people can visualize what you're referring to and maybe decide where they land, where their organization lands. But Siever, it's been such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us, and hope you'll come back again soon.
Thank you very much. This was terrific. I enjoyed it.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.